As he looks toward his departure from the United Nations at the end of the year, Kofi Annan has been looking back on his decade as Secretary General, assessing his own successes and failures, as well as the organization's strengths and weaknesses. In a recent interview with the BBC, he spoke frankly about the situation in Iraq, saying that the war there is one of his biggest regrets. And another big change coming at the end of the year, John Bolton, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, is stepping down from his post. If you have questions about Kofi Annan's legacy and the future of the UN, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us an email to talk@npr.org. And to talk about what all this could mean for the future of the UN, we're joined now by Paul Kennedy. He's a professor of international history at Yale University, and he joins us from his office at Yale. Thanks so much for being with us, Professor Kennedy.
Nice to be back.
Kofi Annan says that he believes that the Iraq War has divided the world, and he has also said that he thought the UN could stop it. Are his comments too little too late?
Well, he's looking back at, obviously, at going out from his 10-year period, where he was, in my view, a very, very good Secretary General, but lots of things happened on his watch, including this Iraq war, including the outbreak of transnational terrorism, including a number of genocides, and also some personnel and mismanagement failures, which cast a cloud over somebody who's tried to do a very good job. And let's go to his comments upon his regrets about Iraq. One of the planks of his message to the world was the community had a responsibility to protect the weak, the poor, to protect those in the midst of chaos and civil war. And Iraq is just a glaring example of how we haven't been able to protect.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was listening to and reading through the transcript of the interview he did with a BBC reporter, and I was struck by the fact that he, more than once, he said, you know, the United Nations is its members. It is as much up to the members as it is up to the Secretary General to ensure that the organization is effective.
Yes.
You know, to what degree is that a cop-out on his part, and to what degree is what he's saying absolutely the truth?
It's absolutely the truth. In fact, it's his job description to be the servant both of the Security Council, the all-powerful 15-member body, and also the servant of the 192-nation government General Assembly. And he is not supposed to get above his masters. He is to do what they say, and therefore when his masters, especially the permanent five veto members on the Security Council, are in disagreement, the organization is paralyzed and the Secretary General is going to get the blame. That's part of his job as well. Every Secretary General gets blamed when the great powers can't agree.
You know, we have some tape from that interview, and this tape came in response to a question about the situation in Darfur and the UN's inability, it would seem, to resolve that situation as well. He's speaking with the BBC's Lise Doucette. Let's listen to that tape.
I think that sometimes one has a tendency to have a simplistic approach, as if one individual can solve this problem. As an individual, I've done my best and I keep pushing, not only the government, say the Sudanese government and all around, and we all need to chip in, whether it was in Rwanda or Srebrenica or Darfur. I think we take lots of people off the hook and give them alibi when you find one person and say, Kofi Annan is responsible. And at that time, I was the head of the peacekeeping operation. And it would be very easy today to say the governments are not responsible. Kofi Annan or Jean-Marie Guénot, the head of peacekeeping operations, are the ones who allowed Darfur to happen. It's easier, it's simple. People may digest that better, but it's not the story. It's not the whole story. And I think we need to really tell the story as completely as possible and in all its complexities. And so to have a scapegoat is fine, but it doesn't solve the problem.
So again, here again, we hear Kofi Annan making the point that the responsibility for Darfur cannot be rested entirely on his shoulders as well. And this obviously a situation that he feels very deeply about, and has said that he wants to make a priority as he leaves the UN.
Sure. Every Secretary General who leaves office warns his incoming successor that one of your job descriptions is to be a scapegoat. We don't want to blame the fact that we cannot have intervention in the genocides in Darfur directly on the Chinese government. They would get too upset at that, so we blame the United Nations. As if we forget that the United Nations is simply a holding company with 192 shareholders in it, five of whom have incredible voting rights.
We are talking with Paul Kennedy, professor of international history at Yale University, about the United Nations and Kofi Annan, and you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. One other thing that Mr. Annan is saying as he is leaving the office of Secretary General, he's talking more again about need for reform at the UN to make the organization reflect the political realities of today as opposed to the political realities of 1945. Looking toward the future, do you think that's really going to happen?
Yes. Hello. I think listeners need to understand that the word reform of the UN is used often at different levels.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Like making it more efficient, making the managerial recruitment system more professional is one level of thinking about reform. But the area where many of the nation states and governments, especially the rising countries in the developing world like India, South Africa, Brazil, think there should be reform is altering the composition of the all-important Security Council.
And in what way? What form would that take? And
well,
wouldn't that be a huge battle in itself in the
Yes,
United
it would
Nations?
Be, because the Constitution and Charter of the United Nations ensures that reform can, a change in the Constitution can only take place with the acquiescence of the five veto members. Let's remember that's the U.S., Russia, China, Britain, and France, and with two-thirds vote of the parliaments of the world in favor of any change. So those are big hurdles. But even if you were to go for them, then you have to ask yourself the question, well, which newer countries which sometimes, some of them didn't exist in 1945, which of them do you think would be promoted to the high table of a permanent veto seat on the Security Council? And so that itself is quite a political battle.
Yeah. Do you think that the UN is in better shape now than when he became Secretary General?
Oh, we forget that he walked straight into the triple disasters of Mogadishu, Srebrenica, Kosovo, and Rwanda, Burundi.
Yeah.
They had just occurred in the previous 2 years, and there was donor fatigue. The U.S. Senate was not agreeing to the American payment of the annual duty-bound dues, which we have to pay. And there was just disaster across the world. He inherited a very leaking vessel.
All right, we are going to continue our discussion about Kofi Annan and the UN after a short break. We'll also be taking your calls at 800-989-8255, and we'll be joined by another guest when we come back. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today, we're talking about the legacy of Kofi Annan and the future of the United Nations, also the politics of John Bolton's resignation. My guest is Paul Kennedy, professor of international history at Yale University. And joining us now is Mark Turner. He is the UN correspondent for the Financial Times, and he joins us from our New York bureau. So good to have you with us, Mark.
Hi.
Let's talk about John Bolton's resignation. We've been talking about Kofi Annan. John Bolton will also be leaving the UN. Interesting politics surrounding that. Mark Turner?
Oh, hi.
Yeah, the politics of that is interesting. I just wanted you to comment on that.
Sure. In the UN, he's really been quite an extraordinary character, in some ways kind of symbolizing an administration that has had a lot of difficulty in its relationship with the outside world. He arrived in the middle of a very contentious reform program and immediately started demanding that all this, a document that was emerging for world leaders to decide on UN reform be renegotiated line by line. This immediately caused a lot of the UN officials to gasp in horror and fear that the whole thing would be pulled to pieces. But we saw kind of an evolution over the time that he was here at the UN. He in the Security Council started off making very sort of aggressive noises about, well, if China doesn't like this, I'm going to push it to a vote anyway, and this sort of stuff. But as time went on, he became considerably more practical, I think, in the Security Council, and actually started doing a lot of deals. What he didn't do very well at all was make friends with the countries from the developing world in the General Assembly, put their backs up a lot, made very abrasive, brusque statements, and also alienated some of his European allies as they tried to do deals. So he had a very kind of a mixed legacy, not as bad as the monster some would make out, but still definitely could be seen to have undermined U.S. standing in the world at the United Nations.
Do you think that the members of the United Nations see this as an opportunity for the United States to make up for past mistakes, the new nominee to this position?
I guess so, to an extent. There's only so much that a UN ambassador is, as it were, that the administration is not. Sometimes people had a sense that Bolton was acting almost as a rogue ambassador, I guess, making policy before the administration had even made its mind up. But overall, essentially, the ambassador is a reflection of the administration's desires, and it's the administration that has been changing fundamentally over the past few months in a far greater willingness to do deals, perhaps because it has no other alternative, really, with the other countries. So whether we see a profound shift with the new ambassador, I'm not sure. On the policy issues, we will see a profound shift. What we might get is a change of atmospherics, a change of style, maybe, you know, someone a little bit more conciliatory, a little bit more welcomed in UN circles. But again, I don't think it's going to completely revolutionize the way the US and the rest of the UN get on. There are fundamental problems in the world right now. The Middle East is a catastrophe. The rich world and the poor world are at loggerheads, and that won't change no matter who you put in the position.
We're talking with Mark Turner, UN correspondent for the Financial Times, and Paul Kennedy, professor of international history at Yale University, about the United Nations and Kofi Annan. If you'd like to join the discussion, the number is 800-989-8255. We're going to take a call now from Joe in Miami, Florida. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
As a conservative, some of Bush's decisions have made me scratch my head, you know. But one of his decisions that I was really happy about was John Bolton. I'm a big fan of his. And it makes me wonder why, even though the Democrats have taken the hill, I'm really annoyed that he's fallen a casualty to what I believe is basically a personality issue. I feel that he's done really well. He represents a lot of the things that our base, the old conservative base that's been left wondering by some of Bush's decisions. He did a good job, and I'm wondering if it's basically boiled down to personality and why his resignation was tendered and taken so, what I feel, easily, and why he didn't lobby a little more for himself, actually, you know?
Mark Turner, do you have any ideas about that?
Well, I'd just like to take issue with the question of if he's done really well. You know, he did help negotiate some pretty important resolutions in the Security Council, and so on that front he did do well. He got through some resolutions on Iran, Lebanon, Korea. These were important achievements. But on what was supposed to be his fundamental job, which is reforming the United Nations, getting the management work a little bit better, getting the corruption, getting the waste, getting the inefficiency out of it, he actually put everyone's backs up and achieved very little indeed. So I'm not sure that he did do that well on that front.
All right, we're going to take another call now from Francesca. She's calling from Michigan. Hi, Francesca.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Hello, this is Francesca. I'm on my way to Indiana. I actually live in Indiana. Thank you for taking my call.
Okay, go ahead.
It's about Kofi Annan, and I feel that he did a wonderful job in the United Nations. I think the problem that we started having was because we as Americans, we do not think that other parts of the world can run anything better than we do. So somebody from the third world got in, Mr. George Bush, the president did not feel comfortable with a third world person running such an organization. And I think that's why he's sending Bolton to go and bully him. And Bolton got in there as a bully. and didn't have time for any of the third world people, any of the under, he didn't want to work with the underdeveloped countries.
All right, let's see what our guests think of what you're having to say there, Francesca. Thanks so much for your call.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Professor Kennedy, what's your reaction to this point that Francesca made, which is a sense that Americans would not give someone from a third world a chance, that they would be critical of somebody's leadership at the United Nations because they are from an underdeveloping country of the third world?
Not really fair. I think that there was a great deal of goodwill in this country when Kofi was appointed, partly because he'd been educated in this country, partly because he got on with senators and congressmen very well. So I don't think it's his origins that are the problem. I think that our administration certainly felt uncomfortable dealing with a large number of developing world countries because their agenda was so essentially different from ours. It was a North-South development, poverty gap, and other agendas, with terrorism and international security being at the secondary level. I think your speaker was quite right in saying that Mr. Bolton was viewed as a bully. I think that he was sent there to shake up assumptions and presumptions, and I think in some cases he did a rather good job in challenging accepted presumptions about what the UN did and its norms. We have a larger than at the UN, larger than at who replaces Mr. Bolton, a large difficulty in dealing with the developing world and its demands, as conservatives would see it, or its needs, as liberals would see it.
All right, let's take a call from Lisa in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Lisa, go ahead.
Hi, my question is for Professor Kennedy. I'm not an authority on the subject at all, but I'm wondering what you think the UN actually could have done to stop the division of the world as a result of the Iraqi war. I mean, when a member of the five permanent members of the United Nations, like the U.S., chooses to go forth with something, it's my opinion, or what I think anyways, that we wouldn't have listened or adhered to anything that they would have had to say anyway. So doesn't that just make the entire United Nations itself a figurehead?
To a large extent, you're right. And this, by the by, was also the underlying assumption of the so-called founding fathers of the UN in 1944-45. It would work only if the great powers allowed it to work. Remember, they were together in a grand alliance against fascism, and they hoped that the Grand Alliance would continue into peacetime. If the Grand Alliance continued and the great powers could hammer out agreements, sometimes giving, sometimes taking, the system works. And it still is the case. If we wanted to agree on intervention in Darfur at the Security Council, we could get that. If we don't agree, that is to say, if the Big Five do not agree, we have to suspend any action and wait until they might agree on perhaps something else.
Mark Turner, I wonder if you can respond to that question as well. And I think the larger question it raises really is then what is the role of the United Nations in contemporary political world?
Well, look, the United Nations does all sorts of things. In fact, if you look at what the UN is up to today, I think people would gasp 10 years ago. It's conducting election monitoring. It's involved in criminal investigations. It's got peacekeeping operations with more than 100, well, around 100,000 troops and civilians in 18 countries. It's got development programs, it delivers food. It really is an enormous organization, but at the end of the day, its beating heart is security and trying to create some sort of world order. Now, as Professor Kennedy said, there was this idea early on that in effect you had five powers allied with each other who would act as sort of global policemen. Now, that fell apart during the Cold War, and you had essentially stability of the world was in the hands of the superpowers. After the Cold War, then there was all this hope that there would be a new world order, the sort of thing that Bush Senior talked about. And the UN peacekeepers were sent in everywhere to do all these highly ambitious missions, and without the tools, without the wherewithal, people without the expertise, to be honest, and it all fell apart. Then we had, a resurgence of American self-confidence and power, and that has also fallen apart in Iraq. So we're in a very interesting position right now. We're back into a time when you have the great powers, Russia, China, Europe, the US, and then some of the rising powers like India, actually by and large doing deals. They disagree over Iran exactly. They disagree over Darfur, but they're passing a lot of resolutions. This year, we've already had, 72, 73 UN resolutions. 2 decades ago, you had about 15. The question is, how do you actually go about policing this stuff? And peacekeepers is not enough. Peacekeepers can't fight wars. They can stand there if people are ready to talk, but that's about it. And that's what the world is still looking for, some kind of viable international peacemaking, peace-enforcing force, and really there's no agreement on that at all. So it's all moving quite quickly. But where the UN stands in that is essentially a meeting room, and occasionally when people want to be helped, the UN can step in and help them. But it can't impose will independently.
Mark Turner is UN correspondent for the Financial Times, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Professor Kennedy, just one last question. What's ahead for the next Secretary General? What does he face, and how well prepared is he for that? How well did Kofi Annan prepare the ground for him, I guess?
Well, Kofi was an insider, consummate insider, involved in the Department of Peacekeeping Operations, was welcomed by all of the staff, one of them. Ban Ki-moon is very familiar with international institutions and negotiations, but he comes not as a UN personnel insider. He comes as somebody who's been very much involved in East Asian international diplomacy, especially negotiations between North and South Korea. Quiet spoken, will not be as impressive in gesture.
Thanks so much for joining us today. Okay. We are just out of time. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Professor Paul Kennedy, he is professor of international history at Yale University. And thanks also to Mark Turner, who joined us from New York. He is the UN correspondent for the Financial Times.
You're welcome.